But that's not why people are buying now. They're buying now as a hedge against, not just is the currency going to lose value, but is, who's the obligor? You're a creditor. To own a currency, you're a creditor. Who's the obligor on the other side of that trade? And are they worthy of the credit? And the answer is it's the government and the banking system, and increasingly zombified corporations. They're not worthy as debtors, as obligors. And so I think people want to hold gold increasingly, not just as a trade, not just as a flip.
Keith Wiener, good morning to you. I should say good evening to you, my friend. How are you?
Doing good. How about you? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. I'm really looking forward to this talk. You're one of the intellectuals here, not only businessmen, but intellectuals in this space that I really look up to. And I really liked picking brains and knowing where your thoughts are. We've had a lot since going on since I've last had you on. We've had some economic news. I would say it's slowing, just depends on what statistic really you look like. We've had some tariffs, and we have really record high gold prices, and it looks like soon to be silver. Give me your 30,000 foot view and tell me what you think.
I think we're in a durable bull market in gold, somewhat to a lesser degree in silver, but I think silver comes with. Beginning of the year, when we put out our gold market outlook report, I said we could see 3,600 on gold, and if we see that, something like $36 on silver. Well, we've passed the silver target, haven't quite touched the gold target. And that's okay. I mean, obviously, you get zigs and zags along the way. We've had a bit of a zag in gold. Prices come off a little bit. But what's interesting about this market, and I think I said this the last time as well, we're not in that endless bear market that we were from the second half of 2011 through 2018 into 2019, which was really a sell the blips market. Every time it would go up, everybody was like, oh my God, I know what's going on, time to sell. And this is a buy the dips market. And so everyone says, oh yeah, if gold goes down to 2,900, I'm going to buy it. But the next guy says, if it goes down to 3,000, I'm going to buy it. And the next guy says, if it goes to 3,100, I'm going to buy it. And you don't see the 2,900. It doesn't mean we couldn't, but the buyers step in more aggressively. And I think this market is durable, quite different from the 2009 to 2011 market. I think that was a market driven by the fear of imminent hyperinflation. And, at the time I thought, and I think I wrote this pretty extensively, if everyone's buying based on a mistake, because we're not going to have hyperinflation imminently in 2009, 2011, obviously we didn't. But if everybody's buying based on this mistake, this may not end well. And, sure enough, it didn't. And then it took years of, time and price action to correct, the world getting ahead of itself a bit. But that's not why people are buying now. They're buying now as a hedge against, not just is the currency going to lose value, but is, who's the obligor? You're a creditor. To own a currency, you're a creditor. Who's the obligor on the other side of that trade? And are they worthy of the credit? And the answer is it's the government and the banking system, and increasingly zombified corporations. They're not worthy as debtors, as obligors. And so I think people want to hold gold increasingly, not just as a trade, not just as a flip, not just, okay, I'm going to buy it and then hopefully the price will go up to whatever, 3,700, and then I'll sell. But rather, I want to hold it as a permanent holding and not necessarily about its price, but it's about, not, as an antidote to counterparty risk. And, if you get a lot of people that want to buy gold and take it off market, obviously that's the formula for a bull market. And that's where I think we're at the moment. And I think that's going to continue to play because governments around the world are not becoming more sane. They're not becoming more sound. They're not becoming more fiscally responsible. They're not cleaning up their credit act, in any way. Obviously, it's the opposite. And that's not new, but I think awareness of it, with each crisis, more people become aware of it. come to gold, turn to gold, buy some, and then, you know, stick it in their sock drawer and forget about it. Well, you know, the current environment is just more, you know, more people doing that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Where are you seeing the buyers? Yeah, who's buying? Is it central banks, or, and again, you've been around the world. Is it a part of the world? Or you go around the world. Is it a part of the world? Different countries? Is it retail? You also work a lot with retail. Is retail investors, are you seeing them starting to really come in markets? Where's the buying coming?
The buying is not retail in the West. Right. So if you talk to, you know, coin and bullion dealers in the US, Canada, UK, that's not a lively place for a lot of action right now. I think there are, well, so to say, larger and more sophisticated investors in the West. Family offices and other institutional investors are taking positions and planning to take positions. Very, very much the opposite of 2013 to 2015, when all those guys were stuck in positions or working through the lockdown, you know, periods in their fund vehicles and all that to get out of gold and you know, be done with it. Now they're, you know, coming in to some degree. But in the rest of the world, a whole different story. You know, here in Dubai, you know, you see kind of the confluence of the Turks, the Indians, the Arabs, less so the Chinese here. But generally, you know, the gold trader. So there are people whose business is basically to buy bars where there's a slight discount, you know, bullion bars, finished refined gold, and then sell it, you know, buy it wherever they can find it at discount, which is often Dubai, and then sell it wherever there's a slight premium, which is often Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong isn't really a big consumption market in itself. It's a conduit to China. So mm-hmm. when you see the trade going Dubai to Hong Kong, it means essentially the Chinese are outbidding the Indians. Because otherwise it would be Dubai to India. And there's plenty of that trade, you know, going on, keeping these traders busy, Dubai to Hong Kong. So Chinese, you know, people are buying, the Indian people are buying, the Turks are buying, Arabs are buying. Those are the four worlds where you get buying, and the central banks are buying. Now, I don't think, you know, I differ from, I think, most of the folks in the space, the gold space, who see the central banks as the primary drivers of the gold price. You know, the amounts they're buying are relatively small compared to the total amount of gold that's above ground and in human hands. But the central banks certainly give, you know, people a sense, you know, a psychological effect could be much, much bigger than their actual effect on you know, bidding up the gold price is encouraging, you know, a billion people to bid up the gold price. And that's what I think. You know, when people see their own central bank buying, they're like, and we're supposed to trust their paper? Well, meanwhile, they're dumping paper to get, you know, to get gold. So, you know, it gives people that sort of psychological room, you know, mental space to give them permission, I guess is the word I'm looking for, to go buy gold. Not that they need legal permission, but psychologically, the concept of permission, I think, is operative.
Yeah. Talk to me. You said a couple of things about, or you dropped some interesting words here. Counterparty risk. What counterparty risk do you see happening right now? And obviously, the central banks are really opening up the spigots, if you would. The Fed included in that, or just recently included in that. But talk to me about counterparty risk, and also talk to me about the bond market. The bond market is really seems to be taking it on the chin here. Especially in the UK, is that the counterparty risk you're seeing, or yeah, just work that out for me.
So in terms of, you know, the central bank's own currency, and I realize I'm very controversial in saying this, you probably won't have any other guests that would agree with this, but it's true all the same. And that is,
I'm taking notes.
Can't express in terms of the central bank's own, you know, paper, a risk or a supply and demand imbalance in terms of the government's own bond. There's a circular relationship, almost a check-cutting scheme between the Treasury and the Fed, or in the case of the UK, you mentioned, you know, between the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Bank of England. It's circular. where the bond is only payable in the central bank's currency, and the central bank's currency is only backed by the bond. So the interest rate does not express risk. It's not an expression of risk at all. And the interest rate is not an expression of, you know, supply and demand, certainly of government, you know, bonds anyways. You know, the interest rate is almost meaningless, and it can rise without bounds, as it did after World War II through 1981, and it can fall without bounds and go negative even, as it did post-1981 until 2022, when all the central banks said, okay, we're going to hike rates now. So what I'm talking about is, you know, if you have a thesis that the government is, you know, making drunken sailors look good by comparison, and they're not going to be good for it. So what's the U.S. government debt up to? $37 trillion now, right? You know, divide that by any reasonable estimate of the number of people working in the productive sector. So there are plenty of people that are, in a certain sense, productively employed by the government. But government employees can't meaningfully pay the debt. Their salaries come from the government itself. It's only people working in the productive sector that can pay. It's about 100 million people. So $37 trillion works out to $370,000 for every working adult. Now, if you have a married couple, yeah, that's 370 times two, $740,000. On top of their pro rata share of their state government's debt, on top of their pro rata share, if you want to sort of apportion corporate debt, business debt, auto debt, student loan debt, mortgage debt, credit card debt, municipal fire district, you know, water district, library district debt, et cetera, et cetera. The sheer amount of it is not only unpayable, but I think it's obvious to anybody who looks at it. It's not, you don't need a PhD in economics to look at it and say, there's no way. This cannot be amortized at any positive interest rate over any human lifetime. It's just far too much on top of everything else. And then people need income to live as well. Like, what percentage of your income can you devote towards paying off federal government's debt? You couldn't take 50% of your income to do that. It's absurd. So that means it's not getting repaid. So, okay, how do you express that thesis? Well, you can't sell the bond to hold the currency. You can't sell the bond to hold a bank deposit. What are you going to hold if you don't trust that debt? Well, gold. Gold is the only thing not denominated in terms of that debt. And so people come to gold when they make that realization. You know, one by one individually. A lot of gold people don't really think it through all the way. They think, oh, everyone's going to sell the bond. Sell the bond for what? For paper currency? So if you don't like the interest rate on the bond, then you're going to hold paper that's yielding zero and still take the same credit risk anyway. So you can sell, you know, you can sell your paper and get gold, but then the person who had the gold is selling the gold and getting the paper. So economically, it has no effect. And that does not affect the interest rate. That's the problem with our world today, is the exit to gold doesn't affect the banking system. This was the brilliance, dare I say, FDR, or under the advice of Keynes, evil but brilliant, an evil genius. And what he did in 1933 wasn't about confiscating for the sake of looting. I mean, I'm sure, you know, everything I've read about FDR, I'm sure the idea of looting, you know, made him, you know, sexually aroused, but or whatever. But it was really about taking away the most conservative saver's option to hold gold and forcing everybody into government paper, because he wanted the interest rate to go down. He didn't want bank redemptions. He wanted to stop the run on the banks. He wanted to stop the selling of bonds. You know, because in those days, if you redeem, you know, your currency for gold, it forced the bank to sell a bond to raise the cash being gold, to pay out the gold coin. So by taking the gold coin out of the system, it was brilliant in disenfranchising everybody, trapping everybody in the system. You know, like a herd of cows that, you know, for slaughter, they're in the pen and they can go round and round and round, but there's no exit, or there's only one exit, and that's not the one that you want if you're a cow. There's one chute that you can go through. But, you know, it's a brilliant move. And people don't, to this day, realize the significance of that. That as long as you want to hold a paper asset, you are a creditor, and you only have a choice of whether you want to be a creditor directly to the Fed by owning Federal Reserve notes. Right, so you have that piece of paper, it doesn't say dollar bill on it, it says Federal Reserve note. You are a creditor to the Fed, and by giving credit to the Fed is extending credit onto the government and the banking system. Or you can hold a banking system deposit, or you can hold a treasury bond. Those are your three choices if you're going to hold a balance of what people insist on calling money. Brilliant. I mean, in terms of, you know, evil genius plans, and I have to emphasize the word evil along with brilliant, you know, here, lest anybody thinks that I'm somehow pumping this or shilling for this. Anyways, you can't express that concern in terms of interest rates. If interest rates are blipping up, that's how the Fed is, or the Bank of England is managing liquidity. You need to suck liquidity out, you get some selling the bonds, you have to reshuffle the bonds, you know, to different balance sheets, and there's a lag to that. But the overall trend of interest rates post 1981, and we're still in that trend, is downwards. And yes, we've had a blip. I think that blip is coming to an end. You know, Powell seems to be signaling that he's, you know, ready to concede that maybe we need to do a cut, you know, coming soon. You know, whether he does it in September, December is not my point. I'm not trying to time it, but all the pressures are downwards. Now, as long as I'm ranting, I want to talk about tariffs. And I think most smart—
I do. I want to talk about tariffs too, and I'm not to interrupt you, but I want to work that out or even give it a comment. Let's pin the thought at tariffs because I really want to get to that.
Okay.
But I want to ask you, really, it seems like we're in a doom loop here because we have a slowing economy. Correct me if I'm wrong, and let me know what you're seeing in different places of the world. We have a Fed cutting or central banks cutting, and we have weaker currencies. This is like Shangri-La for the precious metals, if you would. But yeah, I mean, really, just what is the end game to all of this? Is it just an economy or even a world of just really high prices now, high inflation?
I mean, that could be a step along the way, but at the end of the day, the debt cannot be repaid.
Right.
What cannot be will not be. So there's a default and a collapse.
You see that happening? Loop.
Sorry?
Do you see that in the cards?
Yeah. So I wrote arguably my most important article, When Gold Backwardation Becomes Permanent. And I'm looking at a spread in the gold market, which should never invert, but it did in December of 2008. And then intermittently, you know, for years after that, as a harbinger of real doom, which is, you know, system collapse, societal collapse, government collapse, population collapse, like really, really bad stuff. And, you know, I don't want to dwell on it. I'm an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurs, you have to have a pretty positive view, because otherwise, why would you stick your neck out and put the yoke on your neck and jump into business. I'm really a positive guy, but if we don't avert this, and that's the whole point of my company, Monetary Metals, is try to avert it, try to bring gold back into use in a graceful, like one way or the other, gold's coming back. But we don't want to have to go through a 476 AD type collapse. And then 1,000 years later, gold is, you know, back in use. That's not really, for those of us who are alive now, it's not going to be a lot of fun, to say the least. You know, that's the only way that it can be resolved. The debt is growing exponentially. The debt has to grow exponentially. It's a feature, not a bug, of the design of the system as it's constituted. And there isn't any way to just declare, okay, we'll now make the dollar tied to gold somehow. You can't retroactively do that. You know, a proper gold redeemable currency is one where every currency unit was borrowed into existence by borrowing gold. And that means that every stage along the way, people chose to make that deposit because they trusted the system. If you just take a system where that trust is eroding and now try to say, okay, the currency is redeemable, you're just going to get tons of redemptions until the coffers are drained. And that was the process that was beginning, you know, in the late 60s through 1971 that Nixon put an end to by saying, okay, no more redemptions. So it's like, first, you try putting a penny in the fuse box, and when that doesn't work, you lock the whole fuse box up and say, okay, nobody can see in here anymore, we're done. You're suppressing information and you're stopping, you know, the market from trying to seek an equilibrium, but you're not You're not fixing anything, that's for sure.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. So let's talk about tariffs and really just policy here. Give me your outlook on that and your perspective on that. And it looks like it's a tax on it's a consumer tax here, really here in the US. Yeah. Work
Yeah,
that up.
absolutely. I mean, I say things that I know are controversial and I expect controversy. Like if I say that risk can't be expressed in the interest rate in the treasury bond market, I get why that's controversial. Because there's a whole bunch of, logic and premises behind that are not well accepted. But the controversy over whether tariffs are taxing consumers, whether they're somehow magically taxing only the source country, there shouldn't be any controversy there. I think this is pretty settled economics. Yes, it's taxing consumers, which means prices go up. Now, every socialist has a fantasy of imposing a tax on corporation producers that somehow will not be passed on to customers, which means the corporation is going to consume its own capital to pay the tax. Now, if that were true, that would be really, really bad because you're sucking the capital dry out of these major enterprises. It takes capital to produce at large scale. If you suck all the capital out, then production would collapse. So sooner or later, and a lot of them are trying to avoid increasing their prices because just because your cost goes up doesn't mean your customer wants to pay more. And for anybody who's questioning that, Keith, I'm not sure about that. Go out and buy yourself a brand new BMW on payments and then come to your boss and say, I now have an $800 a month payment and therefore my salary has to go up. And when you realize that's not going to work, you understand why everybody from Walmart to Amazon to McDonald's doesn't necessarily have the pricing power to just try to quote unquote pass on their costs. So what has to happen is this is supply and demand, right? If you want to increase the price, you'll find a new point on the supply and demand curve that's going to shift in one direction where there's less demanded, and therefore X number of stores and producers and manufacturers have to go out of business, and then with the smaller remaining supply, can find the price at which it can clear and be profitable. So this is going to be a process of supply destruction, therefore rising prices to destroy demand, but with a lag. There's a lag because first of all, everyone knew the tariffs were coming, so anybody that was in a position to do so loaded up on inventory ahead of the tariffs. And secondly, it takes a while to work raw materials through the production process and through the supply chain to get to retailers. So, that stuff doesn't hit. You can't look at a CPI number the month after there was a new tariff and say, oh, look, see, they were all wrong. It didn't affect it. It's coming. The other thing that has a long delay is the effect of higher interest rates. So, just read an article yesterday, Southwest Airlines announced that they're closing down 30 routes that they were flying. And I tweeted about this, and my first tweet, I think, was not well understood, but I tweeted the next day and gave a little bit, made a little bit of a thread about this. It's the interest rate that does this. So every business has capital supporting it. And generally that capital is financed, but even if it isn't, even if you were just in a position to own it outright, there's an interest rate that prevails on the market, and you have to produce a return on capital greater than the cost of capital. So suppose, even if you weren't borrowing money, if you had $1 million, why would you put it into your own business earning 3% if the prevailing market rate was 5%? Let
You
alone
wouldn't.
if you're borrowing at 5%, you certainly can't be earning 3%. So which means is every business that generates a return on capital less than the market rate has to be shut down and liquidated. So
Jeez.
every route, I don't know how many airplanes an airline would dedicate to a route. I guess it depends on how many flights a day. But let's assume two a day. So that's, two airplanes. Those airplanes are like 120 million each. And then you have ground equipment as well. At the terminals, all that stuff is millions of dollars, I'm sure. So call it $250 million in capital for every route. Now, at when the Fed funds rate was zero, the borrowing cost to an airline might have been 2.5%. So they have to earn on that route, $6.25 million a year to be viable. What happens if the interest rate, if the Fed funds rate goes up to 5%, then the spread widens a little bit. Now they have to pay 8%. Well, they need $20 million a year. And if your route can't go from making six and a quarter to 20, it has to be shut down. So higher interest rates means shutting down stores, factories, airline routes, you name it, has to be shut down when it can't make. You're raising the hurdle. It's just like if you raise the minimum wage from $10 an hour to $20 an hour, every worker who was producing more than 10 but less than 20 has to be laid off. You can't employ somebody for a greater cost than what he's producing. So it's the same thing here, only now it's the rate of interest. So higher rate of interest means you have to shut down enough supply so that prices can adjust and the airlines can get on whatever remaining supply that they provide, they can get a return on capital greater than the cost of capital. Now enter tariffs and you create this perfect storm. I think most smart economists would quibble when I say that the common definition, most people treat the word inflation to mean rising prices. And they would quibble and say, well, rising prices due to monetary forces. They sort of would acknowledge you can have non-monetary forces that cause prices to go up, but they didn't really acknowledge it. It certainly isn't taken into account in any way in the CPI. So tariffs are certainly going to cause rising prices. And the fix for rising prices, the policy fix for the Fed, is hike the interest rate. Now you're going to hike the interest rate, which is, as we just explained, going to destroy capacity. That will cause prices to go up further. And then if they were to really pursue this, as they did through, the 1960s and 1970s, you'd have a ratcheting effect of ever higher prices and ever higher interest rates. Except today, the debt levels are so obscenely high. People worry about the US government's ability to service its debt. They're the last ones in the world who are going to have a problem. What about all those corporate borrowers, business borrowers, student loans, auto loans, et cetera? Now, home loans don't reset. But, auto loans, once you're done with the car and you get the next car, obviously it's a whole new interest rate. And if people are struggling at when the Fed funds rate is zero and the auto loan for, not subprime, but let's call it middle of the road consumers is 3% or something, what happens when the Fed funds rate is 5 or 6?
Yeah.
That rate is going to be 10. Nobody can afford it at 10. So then, volumes drop. And of course, the car companies have to get a higher return on whatever dwindling asset base they have. It's just going to be this process of liquidation, layoffs, just this horrible economy, rising prices, rising unemployment, rising interest rates, just shit all around, and then probably more tariffs because those globalists are still killing American workers. We have to raise tariffs even more. And then you just get this toxic stew that just spirals and spirals and spirals. That would be my fear of a worst case, scenario.
It seems like this is hitting right now, like really literally right now, where inflation seems to be sticky, if you would. I'm not using the word transitory, but using the word sticky. And then you have a Fed with inflation being sticky, you have a Fed or even central banks again around the world that are beginning to lower interest rates or wanting to lower interest rates to flood the system with money. Really, my question is how does the banking sector make any money in this environment?
That's a real problem, right? So
Right?
they have to find some speculative, avenue. The one thing I want to say, by the way, and this is perverse as it is, there are many, many harmful effects caused by setting interest rates too low. However, if you wanted to ignore all of those and your only concern was consumer price index, you would want lower interest rates because every time you take the interest rate down, it's an additional incentive to open up more production capacity.
Right.
And perversely, if you wanted higher prices for some reason, raise the interest rate because that will cause higher prices. So the conventional theory has got the sign wrong. I remember when I was, I want to say a teenager, there was a mission. It was a space shuttle launch that they canceled because they realized it was a bug in the code where they treated the gravity of the moon was a negative sign. It was repulsive rather than attractive. And so if they had launched with that bug in the code, obviously, it would have destroyed the space shuttle and killed some people. So they thankfully aborted it. They have the sign wrong on their approach to interest rates in terms of consumer prices. So I just wanted to say that. But what was your question again? Because I was getting to that.
Well, it's really, how is the banking sector going to make money?
So as the interest rate falls, the spread between the bank's borrowing cost and its lending price, you know, is compressed.
Right.
So, you know, lower interest rates both enable greater amounts of leverage and actually require it. So at a normal interest rate, you might be able to run, you know, something like a bank unleveraged because, you know, there's a decent spread in the middle. And, you know, there was a scene from book Lombard Street in the 19th century in London, where there's an old banker kind of taking young banker under his wing, so to speak, and said, boy, the banking business, a simple business and a boring business, you know, provided you could tell a bill from a mortgage. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't super glamorous. It wasn't attracting all the top, you know, brightest minds from every top college and university around the world. It was a relatively boring business and they made money. But, you know, they were well-to-do, but they weren't like billionaire rock stars. And but as the interest rate comes down, not only do you have to lever up, but actually it enables you to lever up because the cost of money is so cheap. So the banks are getting it a bit cheaper than anyone else, can lever up, you know, to the max. And then they're financing whatever asset is going up, whether it be real estate, whether it be, hopefully they're not going to get into the Bitcoin thing with bank leverage. We'll see about that. Something tells me that
massive amounts of leverage there. Go ahead.
But not bank leverage at the moment.
Yeah. Systemic leverage, though. I mean, a lot of companies, a lot of people are borrowing now to buy a Bitcoin and they borrow against it.
Right. Yeah, that's called looping, where they borrow to buy the Bitcoin. And then once they have the Bitcoin, they pledge the Bitcoin to borrow more and buy more Bitcoin. So that's really a lot of fun on the way up for everybody who's selling as it goes up, and not so much fun on the way down for everybody who bought with leverage.
Right.
You know, there's a wicked fall that will come when that saturates. But, you know, one way or the other, there has to be a rising asset price. You know, the banks have to participate in one way or another, you know, as the interest rate comes down. But the banks are going to have to do that. They have no choice because the interest rate's going to come down because there's no business demand for credit at higher interest rates. Now, tariffs may artificially create some because let's say you're a sleepy little factory. I think I read there's one company left in the U.S. that makes nails. The rest are probably all made in China or someplace like that.
Wow.
Right. That's so now if you tariff the hell out of nails, then, okay, now there's demand for the U.S., you know, nail manufacturing industry, that company plus others who are adjacent enough to it that can get into the nail business if they want to borrow to build, you know, nail manufacturing plants, you know, in the U.S. So you can artificially create some demand for credit. But generally, the demand for credit is only occurring on a downtick in the interest rate. And that's mm-hmm. where we've been, you know, for years and years. And for many years, I've been writing, I think I've been writing about this since at least 2013 or 2014. Look at the car makers offering 0% financing on cars, which persisted even through Powell hiking rates. Now, I happen to be in Dubai at the moment, and things are booming here. This is a different economy than what you see in the U.S. because everybody in places around the rest of the world with the tax system is just terrible, or the regulation, you know, whatever it is, especially Europeans, are flocking here. So you have a serious growth in population, and with that, all the booming and related, you know, residential construction industry, home furnishings, all that stuff, and obviously people buying cars when they come here. But car companies here are offering 0% financing. So there's still that 0%, even though that is a subsidy offered by the manufacturer and the cost of that subsidy. I wrote an article in 2017, estimating the cost to Ford of offering that subsidy would probably be on the order of $1 billion. And Ford's profits were on the order of $5 billion, like 20% of their profits out the window, subsidizing, you know, the buyer with just 0% cents. Once the interest rate is hiked, the cost of that subsidy is much greater, and they still do it. Why? Because if they didn't do it, volumes would fall off the cliff.
Right.
Volumes would fall so much, they would be losing more money by the collapse in volumes than they would by offering the subsidy, as much as the subsidies cost. And that, I think, epitomizes the entire, credit world. The demand for credit only really ticks up when the price of credit ticks down. And it's been that way, for 40 years. We're sucking the life, we're sucking the juice out of the economy. And every time you take that sponge or that washcloth and you wring it tighter, there's still one more drop to be had if you change your grip and, do even more. And that's that falling interest rate. That's how you get, another little boom. You get asset prices to blip up even more. You get more economic activity, all of it on an unsustainable basis, of course. But that's the game of how they try to manage this great moderation, this new economy. I just want to think of every bogus word that they've offered, in the last 30 years, for what they're doing, which is, micromanaging interest rates and managing a decline. And every time it drops, you get some more economic activity at that level. All of which is just destruction. It's just capital consumption. But it's a lot of fun, while it lasts.
Yeah. Talk to me. You're in Dubai right now. And that's really a great, if you would, model for business, if you would. Do you see other countries or parts of the world adopting that model, if you would, just because it's been so successful and such a boom for that economy right there and that really that area right there?
Well, regionally, there are two obvious players that are working on that exact thing, which is Qatar and Saudi, both of which have not really been, Saudi particularly, not open at all. But, there's always been a rivalry between UAE, Qatar, and Saudi. And UAE has taken a big lead, and the other two are more than a little jealous, as I see it. And, what they built in Dubai is phenomenal. And I think Saudi wants in on that action, and they're trying to build a city of finance and a city of trade and all these things. Whether that'll be successful, I don't know. I think time will have to tell. But they certainly want to open up. They certainly want to welcome Western corporations and Westerners. I think the challenge they have is they were obviously very religiously conservative and very, repressed for a long, long time. You can't just declare, okay, new king, new policy. Now we're going to be open and we're going to have Western women walking around in short dresses and everyone's going to be drinking. You'd have a revolution. So there's only so fast you can impose that kind of change. But here in Dubai, I would call it open. Anybody who wants to drink can drink. I'd say most of the locals drink as well, but certainly the Westerners, it's not hard to find, what you want. They do have laws, restricting, like a liquor store can't have any signage. It's like a plain, almost boarded up looking thing, and there's a door, and you have to know, oh, that's the liquor store in the mall, and you go in, obviously it's all liquor. They want to see your passport. They don't really want the locals, unless they have a liquor license, to buy, booze. But with your passport, it doesn't cost anything to take that passport number and you buy whatever you want. They have a lot of lifestyle, developments, whether it's skyscrapers, whether it's on the beach, whether it's, a villa in the hills. They have all the products to sell people on the lifestyle. And that attracts more people and creates more business. And it's very much a pro-business environment. Now, could the rest of the world adopt it? Well, it's basically the Singapore model. So Singapore has this model, and they're booming as well, of course. Will the rest of the world adopt it? Well, I'm not sure I see Europe doing any such thing. I'm not sure the U.S. is not headed in that direction, right? And China is headed towards a more authoritarian direction. So, where else could it be adopted? And Australia and New Zealand, probably not either. Where else could it be adopted? Perhaps Africa, and perhaps other, Southeast Asian countries. I think India is reforming slowly as they do, moving in a better direction from what I hear. Maybe Africa, maybe certain countries like Ghana will really step up and want to build, this kind of environment.
It's interesting to me that the countries that are, if you would, opening up or pro-business, low, if not no taxes, if you would, on assets, those are also the same countries just from the talk I had with you, that are buying most of the gold, or all of the gold, if you would. There's quite a correlation there, right?
If your income is $20 a year, you can't buy very much gold, even if you love gold. If your income is $200,000 a year, you can buy a hell of a lot more gold. That's true. Now, most of the gold that's bought here at retail is not held by people who live here. I mean, you know, there's a market here. I think the population is, what, 8 million people? And those people do buy gold and own gold and keep it here. But most of the gold that's being sold, let's say in the gold souk, is tourists that are coming here, buying it, and then taking it back. So that's a testament to low VAT and, you know, travel-friendly, you know, visa policies and other things like that. So particularly from India, you know, they come here, they can buy, you know, kilo worth of jewelry, I think, and bring it back duty-free, whereas imported into India would be, now it's a 6%, had been a 16% tariff, or import duty, excuse me, on you know, gold jewelry. So that's where I think most of the volume is. The population of India is like 1 billion people. Population of here is 8 million. That's where the volume is.
Yeah.
And as India has, you know, increases per capita income, you know, they buy more gold.
Got it. Where do you think, if you would project out 3 to 6 months, and we'll end on this, if you can, what do you think? Yeah, give me just your thoughts on what people need to be aware of, and also just really, especially specifically in the precious metals markets, gold and silver.
As I said, I think we're in a bull market. Obviously, we're in the stage right now that's not just, it's not gone parabolic, you know, by any means. I think it's just with zigs and zags, you know, the price goes up, which means the dollar's going down. So we had hit 9 milligrams on the dollar. And I think that's really the way to look at it. This is not gold going up. Gold goes nowhere. Gold is a lighthouse sitting on the rocks, and we stand on the ship labeled USS Dollar, which is both slowly sinking, and there's a big storm going up and down. And we're like, why is the lighthouse going up and down and mostly up? Well, your vantage point is wrong. That's why. So we hit a low on the dollar of about 9 milligrams, just under, and that will continue to fall, which means everybody doesn't own gold, you know, slowly losing their, you know, their savings, their capital, which is tragic and will have horrible, you know, consequences to everything else in life. But the price of the gold will go up. So if you want to sell your gold, you know, you can cheer that. If you want to keep your gold, that doesn't really do you a lot. It's like living in a house for 30 years, the price goes up. That lot of good that does you, except the tax assessor comes along and hikes your taxes every once in a while. If I can plug my company, Monetary Metals,
please,
you want to hold your gold and not sell it, you can't make any, there's no profit to be had until you sell it, unless you're a Monetary Metals client. We pay you interest on it. We pay 4% on it in gold. So yes, you can keep your gold, not sell it, and still make money on it by earning interest on it.
And
yeah, I think that proposition matters in this environment, because people aren't buying the gold to sell, they're buying the gold to hold.
Right.
Very different, you know, mindset.
Yeah, no, it's a great business model, Keith, where people want to do business with you if they want to buy gold, they want to earn interest on their gold that they own. How do they go about reaching out to you?
Monetary-metals.com is our website. And on Twitter, I'm at Real Keith Wiener, which is K-E-I and W-E-I, because I have imposters, you know, misspell my name to steal my traffic or whatever they think they're going to get.
Got it. Well, Keith, the two things, we'll end on that. I'll put all of this in the show notes, as well as in the YouTube video, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Also, I have a new name for you. It's not Keith Wiener. It's John Gold.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the sentiment. I'm not sure I would try to step off to fill John Galt's fictional shoes, but appreciate that.
Well, I'd love to have you on again as soon as, but it was too long since the last time. Yeah, you're a very busy guy, but you always have time for me. And yeah, I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.